You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and on today's show, we're going to look at a particularly dark period in American history that we tend to kind of skip over during our educations in grade school and high school. And this period also has some very important parallels to issues we're facing today. It's captured in a book that came out in 2022 called American Midnight, The Great War, A Violent Peace, and Democracy's Forgotten Crisis. Adam Hochschild is the author, and he's here as my guest today on Heartland Politics. Adam, thank you so much for taking the time today.
You bet. It's good to be with you, Robin.
Well, I'm interested in your take on this period of history that we, as I said in the introduction, we tend to glide over. Can you talk about that a little bit as kind of your purpose for writing this book and what periods we tend to bookend around this that we skip over?
Well, I think it's no accident that I began work on this book during the Trump administration, a time when we were all worried about political repression in America, about the erosion of democracy in many different ways. And I had always been interested in a somewhat forgotten stretch of American history where I think that happened before. And that's the story I tried to tell in American Midnight. And that's why I tried to tell the story when I did. And that period is 1917 to 1921, which we don't think of as a period the way we think of the 30s as a period, or the Second World War as a period, or the 50s as a period. But to me, it's a very distinct period because two things happened in 1917 that set off a kind of almost unprecedented wave of political repression in this country. The United States declared war on Germany in April of that year, and going to war can do strange things to a country, and it certainly did to us. And then in November of that year came the Russian Revolution, and there was great paranoia among ruling circles in the United States that somehow that revolution might spread to this country. A totally unrealistic fear, I think, but it provided the excuse for a crackdown on the left and on labor movements, which those in power had been wanting to do for a long time. So that's basically the story I tell in American Midnight.
The irony of Woodrow Wilson, I remember growing up in my education, he was seen as one of the top presidents in our country's history, very idealistic. But as you read more about some of his particular policies and attitudes, it's not as alluring. But he comes into office at this time, and his administration invokes some really tough policies, but there's a broader irony here, isn't there, about his approach?
Well, you're right. Wilson was a complicated guy. He is not somebody that I find possible to loathe unconditionally, something I could say of one or two more recent presidents. He did have an idealistic side. He was a progressive in the terms of the day on issues like child labor, regulation of business, the eight-hour day, that sort of thing. And he had a tremendously idealistic streak in him and was a big backer of the League of Nations. And who can deny that the idea of countries negotiating their differences around a table is far better than going to war? And in a way, he sort of sacrificed his health and shortened his life by that, because in 1919, when sentiment in the United States was somewhat against the League of Nations, while in very frail health, he made a speaking tour across the country, begging people to put pressure on their senators to ratify the Versailles Treaty, which had the League of Nations in it. And on that tour, he exhausted himself, had the first of two near fatal strokes that basically put him out of commission for the rest of his presidency. So that was his idealistic side. At the same time, he presided over what I think we can call the greatest period of political repression in the United States since the immediate aftermath of slavery. Between 1917 and 1921, there was press censorship on a huge scale. Some 75 newspapers and magazines were shut down by the government, and print was the medium of communication of the day. There was no internet, no radio, no TV, no email. During those 4 years, roughly 1,000 Americans went to prison for a year or more, and a much larger number for shorter periods, solely for things that they wrote or said. I don't mean that nobody was doing anything violent during that period, because there was some political violence, but these are people who were political prisoners who were jailed for books they wrote or speeches they'd given and so forth. There was also an enormous nationwide government-sponsored vigilante group, which went around roughing up people who were, they thought, might be dodging the draft and doing other such things. So it was a very nasty time.
And you put this in the context, and for our listeners, what your book looks at, and you talk about some specific divisions in American society that our listeners, that I want you to talk about a little, that our listeners will find very familiar to what's going on today.
Well, there were, I think what happened was this, that the events that I mentioned, the U.S. entering the First World War and then the fear of the Russian Revolution, served as sort of ignition sparks for tensions that were already very deep in American society. One was between business and labor. The U.S. was a very violent place on that issue. Dozens of people were routinely killed every year in labor strife. For example, in 1913-14, more than 70 people, many of them women and children, were killed in a Colorado mine workers strike, killed by company guards and state militia. So that was a conflict that was already roiling this country. Then there was the longstanding conflict between Black and white Americans as Black people struggled for their rights. Dozens of people were routinely lynched every year. And that conflict got further revved up under the pressure of war and fear of revolution. And finally, there was a longstanding conflict, violent at times, between nativists and immigrants. You know, this country has long seen that, with the normal thing being that people whose ancestors have been here for two or three generations get angry at new arrivals whose ancestors are usually coming from a different part of the world. You know, today, the target of that wrath from the right is people mainly from Latin America, but not entirely from Latin America, coming over the southern border. 100 years ago, it was people arriving from Europe, but arriving from southern and eastern Europe, whereas most white Americans had their ancestry in northwestern Europe, England, Germany, and so forth. The arrivals from southern and eastern Europe were mostly Catholic and Jewish. And that felt foreign, strange, threatening, and so forth. So that was another tension in this period that got very much inflamed by the nature of the times.
I thought it was interesting, too, you focus on several women that were activists and played prominent roles during this period, and that were jailed under very flimsy circumstances. You might take a minute and highlight a couple of these women, because I think right now, with women running for president again and the heightened role of women in our society, I think it's interesting to see the sacrifices that some of those made in the past.
Absolutely. Well, of course, we've always been, you know, had half the population are women, even though before 1920, American women could not vote. There are several that I focus on in my book. One is the feminist and anarchist Emma Goldman, a wonderfully colorful character, who, like many of the people in the book, was imprisoned for her resistance to the First World War. Like a lot of Americans, she felt there was absolutely no reason for the U.S. to engage itself in this terrible, terrible war, the worst that the world had yet seen, between powers in Europe. She said so forcefully, strongly, repeatedly, and not only was sent to jail for this, but was expelled from the country for the rest of her life. And another woman I follow is the very fiery, red-haired socialist orator, Kate Richards O'Hare, who is probably the most prominent woman in the Socialist Party, an enormously popular speaker, and a reminder that there is a real tradition of progressivism, of radicalism in the Midwest, in the rural parts of the country. You know, a socialist stronghold, for example, was Oklahoma. Anyway, Kate Richards O'Hare had grown up in Kansas and Missouri, was enormously popular in such states. She too was sent to prison for speaking out against the U.S. entering the First World War. And actually, she found herself in an adjoining cell to Emma Goldman. And the two women became great friends, even though they came from different political traditions outside and might well have argued in debates and so on there. And when you're a writer like me who likes to base your book around lively, colorful, specific characters, when two of your characters get to know each other and each of them leaves a written record of what they remember about the other, it's just a writer's dream.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm very, very pleased to have as my guest today, Adam Oakeshill, who's written a book. It seems like it's new. It's taken me a while to read it, but it came out in 2022, national bestseller. It's called American Midnight, The Great War, A Violent Peace, and Democracy's Forgotten Crisis. This is a period of American history that it's important for us to learn from, for lessons that we can learn today. And so far, Adam's been talking a little bit about something, kind of setting the stage for the book, talking about the main focus of the book. One thing that you kept referring to that's another forgotten piece of history for me, anyway, was the Philippine War that seemed to have an impact on the American response to strikes, to protests, to dissidents. Can you reflect on that a little bit for me, please?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked me about that, Robin, because I think it's an important and neglected part of American history. One of those things we tend to learn something in high school history books, but they skip over a lot of stuff. We learned that there was the Spanish-American War in 1898, which happened to result in the United States taking over Spanish colonies all over the world, Guam, the Philippines, Cuba, Puerto Rico, and so forth. But many people in the Philippines had been struggling for their independence from Spain and did not want to become an American colony. And there was a very bitter, nasty war that lasted from 1899 till 1902. And sporadically continued in fits and starts after that, that left several hundred thousand Filipinos dead. And that, like so many guerrilla wars, involved widespread systematic torture, where the people waging it were torturing the guerrillas to find out where other guerrillas were hidden and so forth. Not only is there abundant written evidence of this, there are even photographs of Americans doing this to captured Filipino guerrillas. So it was a particularly horrible war, and I think the first of a number of nasty wars in Asia which have left their scars in this country. The Philippine War, the Vietnam War, the Iraq War, the war in Afghanistan, all of these wars happening in Asia, all of their effects coming back home. And again, as I was researching this period that came 2 decades later, 1917, 1921, I was amazed to find how many of the key actors had been, you know, had their opinions and ideas formed by their experience in the Philippine War. Just to give you one example, one of the key figures in the Philippine War was a U.S. Army officer named Ralph Van Diemen, who in 1899 found himself in charge of intelligence in the Philippines, where he developed a system of surveillance, had spies all over the country, keeping records in the form of file cards, which was the information management technology of the day, file cards on suspected Filipino guerrillas and independence advocates. And he amassed tens of thousands of these file cards at his headquarters in Manila, and this helped to steer U.S. military operations there. Well, his assignment in the Philippines came to an end. That war died down. In 1917, Van Diemen found himself in a desk job in Washington in the War Department. And as soon as the war started, he went to his boss. Actually, he went over the head of his boss, went directly to the Secretary of War, and said, "We need to have a military intelligence operation for the United States in this great conflict." But what he was thinking about was not military intelligence in terms of spying on the German army, because the British and French had been at war with them already for almost 3 years and had that operation well underway. He wanted to use military intelligence to spy on American citizens, and he did. And within a year, he had 1,000 people working for him, military and civilian, and some of them volunteers. He had agents all over the country. He was amassing thousands of pages of records about Americans whom he considered subversive. And you can find all these things in the National Archives today. Accounts of people starting labor unions, accounts of Black people demanding their rights. One of the people he spied on was the grandfather of Martin Luther King Jr. So this was somebody who was influenced by the Philippine War and then turned his guerrilla fighting fervor on his fellow Americans.
Another person that was shaped by that war that played a role in this book, a major role in your book, who also became, which I didn't realize, a leading presidential candidate in the election of 1920 was Major General Leonard Wood. I have heard of him because there's a fort named in his name for him in Missouri, I believe. But you might discuss him a little bit in the context of his role in this repression, and then the fact that he actually did pretty well in the primary process in 1920.
He did. Leonard Wood was an officer in the Philippine War, presided over, knew about a lot of the very torture and other stuff that was going on there. He was a close friend of Theodore Roosevelt, which certainly helped his rise through the army ranks and so forth. By the time the 1920 election was approaching, he threw his hat in the ring. Theodore Roosevelt, incidentally, had hoped to run again in 1920, but he died some months before the election. And his family said, and he had been planning to have Leonard Wood as his vice president, eventual candidate. And Roosevelt's family encouraged Wood to run. Wood needed no encouragement whatever, declared his candidacy, and right up to the last minute was the leading contender for the Republican nomination for president. His counterpart on the Democratic side was Wilson's Attorney General, A. Mitchell Palmer, who right up to the last minute was considered the leading Democratic candidate. Each of these men got the largest share of the votes on their party's first ballot, but neither of them got the nomination. Interestingly, both of them were running on platforms that sound very familiar today, promising mass deportation. of immigrants. And in Wood's case, you know, we're saying, why limit deportations to non-citizens? You know, we can deport troublemakers as well. So this strain of blame everything on immigrants, blame everything on newcomers, deport people by the millions, this is something that's been with us in this country for well over 100 years.
And Palmer is known for the Palmer raids, which I was somewhat aware of. There was a lengthy article about the Palmer raids in the New Yorker magazine a couple of years ago.
That was my article. That material is repeated in this book.
I think it was, now that you mentioned that. But I'm reading this and it's just shocking that this occurred in our country.
It is. Palmer, and remember, this is a time when people were stirred up about the danger of revolution. They were very aware of this revolution in Russia, and there were sort of outbreaks of revolutionary regimes in Germany and Hungary immediately after the First World War. And the right wing in this country, you know, fanned the flames on this in order to make it as an excuse to crack down on people. Wilson's attorney general, A. Mitchell Palmer, who had his eye on the presidential nomination, carried out in late 1919, early 1920, what are known as the Palmer raids, where basically got the Bureau of Investigation, which was the predecessor of the FBI, to round up roughly 10,000 people who were candidates for deportation, because there were people who had lived in this country for a long time, but for one reason or another had not regularized their American citizenship. And these were folks that Palmer wanted to deport, and he wanted to deport them conspicuously in a way that would help his presidential campaign. He was foiled in that by a man who's one of the heroes in my books, Lewis F. Post, who was a government official who was acting Secretary of Labor. And because the Immigration Bureau fell under the Labor Department, Post had to approve any deportations, and he found excuses to invalidate the arrest warrants for most of them, made Palmer absolutely furious. It didn't stop Palmer from thundering away about the need for deportations and the danger of revolution. Palmer made the mistake that sometimes many people in power do, which is to believe things that underlings tell them when the underlings are telling the overlings that in order to fulfill what they think the people above them want to know. Palmer repeatedly predicted that May Day, the International Workers' Holiday, May 1st, 1920, there would be a coordinated communist uprising throughout the United States. This made headlines everywhere. Cities put extra police on duty. New York City, for example, had all three shifts of its police force on duty, one shift on the street, the other two waiting in station houses. J.P. Morgan hired extra guards. They posted National Guardsmen and security people around bus terminals and ferry terminals and railroad stations. May 1st, 1920 came, and nothing happened. Absolutely nothing. This really took the wind out of the sails of Palmer's presidential campaign and was one reason why a few weeks later, I think he did not get the nomination. But it just shows how far paranoia can go.
Well, in the time we have left, we just have a couple minutes. I want to allow you plenty of time. You kind of hit on some of the things that finally led to this period, the things calming down and reverting back to more normalcy and easing up on repression. You mentioned the heroic efforts of Lewis Post and the lack of anything on the May Day rallies. Kind of finish up here with our listeners, and I'm going to add There's some other familiar names in the book that we won't get to today, but it's a reason to go buy it. Eugene Debs, J. Edgar Hoover, Oliver Wendell Holmes make appearances in this book. But so I'm hoping to pique interest for folks to go out and buy it. But what else led to this easing of tensions? And what's kind of the major legacy takeaway for us today?
Well, I wish I could say that the tensions eased because tens of millions of Americans realized, hey, we went too far, we made terrible mistakes, let's never do anything like this again. But it didn't exactly happen that way. I think the fact that this predicted communist revolution did not happen not only took the wind out of the sails of Palmer's presidential campaign, but out of this Red Scare period generally. And then I think the tension eased partly because it had accomplished its purpose. I think the ruling circles in this country wanted to crush the left. They crushed the most militant wing of the labor movement, the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, really shattered as an organization and never really recovered. The same could almost be said of the Socialist Party. I don't think it would have become a major force in American politics, but you know, there were dozens of Socialist Party officials who were in jail, many of them for a year or more, and that crippled the party greatly. And in other ways as well, this period was a terrible one for the labor movement. So I think people in power felt, okay, you know, we've accomplished our purpose. It's okay to start letting people out of jail. Eugene Debs, whom you mentioned, was the probably the country's most famous political prisoner, who'd been sentenced to 10 years for simply for giving a speech opposing the First World War. Warren Harding became president after Wilson, and Harding released Debs, not only released Debs from jail, but invited him to stop in Washington for a visit on his way home. And when he left the White House after that visit, Debs said to reporters, "I've run for president 5 times, but this is the only time I've actually gotten to the White House." So things did become eased, but it was a changed country. The 1920s were a time where, you know, we made very little progress. Labor union membership shrank. No significant social legislation was passed.
And I think I'm glad we're going to end up on that, because you speculate, one of the more interesting speculations is the fact that perhaps the reason the United States lagged other Western countries on having national health care was the crackdown on the socialists who were pressing for systems like that. So I think that's another interesting point that was made in your book.
Yeah. I mean, again, the idea of national health care is not an original one. There were people, you know, socialist member of Congress was talking in 1916, 1917 about something very close to what Obamacare is today.
Fascinating. Adam, thank you so much for being on Heartland Politics today. Adam Hochschild has been my guest today. He's the author of American Midnight, The Great War, A Violent Peace, and Democracy's Forgotten Crisis. He's authored several other very interesting books, and I'm going to be getting some of those. I like your style of investigating these parts of history that maybe we didn't look at closely in our education. So, Adam, thank you again, and I hope to have you back sometime.
Thank you, Robin. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.